course, even though Paul McCartney is on the long and winding road, we're not sure whether William Sitwell is indeed on a long and winding road or whether he's there at all. Are you? No, no, he's that's definitely the sign of somebody who's not on the long and winding road. So it would seem, Claire, the only thing to actually do is to do a live connection and hopefully sort of dial him up, you know, whilst we're on air, which it's racy.
And we can,
but,
we can surprise him.
Well, a surprise is clearly open to the surprisee in terms of how surprised they actually are. See, it's raining now outside as well. It's dreadful. You don't know what's sort of happening. But let's see if anything is actually happening now with the sort of system. Yeah, well, it's ringing, so that's a good start, you know. So good news as far as that's concerned. Multitasking to the fore now. Is he going to pick it up?
Good morning.
Good morning, William. Yay! Happiness abounds, you see. And clearly, having Rachel Riley as the official warm-up act for William Sitwell has obviously worked on that basis.
Yeah, it's definitely.
Nice. It was Rachel, our TV presenter, mathematician, and general all-round wonderful person, apart from William supporting the wrong side in Manchester. Has to be said. She was talking about Saturday jobs and the fact that it's Small Business Saturday this coming Saturday. And we thought, well, William, clearly you might well like to share some of your own experiences in the Saturday job scenario. We've already found that Claire Margerison used to be a waitress.
I did.
And also, so did Mary Dancy. Oh, and Emma Tinson, who's left us to do her TV work, also used to be an elf. So, elves or waitresses, have you actually sort of anything to top that, William? Or was it a case of, no, I've always actually been a Renaissance foodie expert?
I've never had a Saturday job.
There you go.
I've had jobs.
Yeah.
I've had jobs that have entailed working on Saturdays.
Ah.
Right. And I've had terrible jobs.
Yeah.
I've been a cab driver. What else have I done?
Who have you had in the back of your cab then, William? I mean, you know, this is the whole new fields.
I once had a Ghanaian army general, and he came to London to shop for his buy shoes for his seven wives.
Oh my!
And then they had a man called Mr. Ali Baba, and it was my job to drive him from one side of the Edgware Road to the other. He paid me £2, and I worked for a company called Abacar. They were a cab firm based in Marble Arch.
Do you know, I think
my call sign was 855.
I might have used Abacars. I'm sure I did. They never went south of the river after midnight. So that was a kind of classic line that's obviously much, much.
Well, the other thing is, I never knew where I was going anyway. So, if I'd gone south of the river, I wouldn't have realised it.
What a wonderful treat, though, you know, to actually have that experience of we're in the cab being driven by William Sitwell. And this could actually be this. I mean, we've already suggested, you know, Rachel Riley and Barack Obama make food for you, you know, make breakfast as a possible series
That's
title.
Exciting.
Get in the cab with William is a winner, I feel.
I think
you can have that free of charge, William, as the next sort of thing that Brown Media can actually sort of have as a marketing thing. Get in the cab with William and you can drive them wherever, and we don't know, and that'd be the whole thing. It would knock spots off I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and you could have that as well, of course. Get me out of this cab. Sorry, William, I'm free-forming today. It's been a sort of a fun week in all sorts of ways.
I think you said you're free-falling. Yeah.
Free-falling, free-wheeling, and all sorts of other factors. The other key thing which has been themed today, of course, is the importance of grandparents, who now actually make up such a significant portion of the UK economy. You know, my grandparents actually died before I was born, so obviously they got out quite early then. You were saying, Claire, that your grandmother was German?
Yes, yeah, she came over from Germany in 1956, I think.
Excellent.
And has lived here since, and she's done a variety of things, such as, like, she's done A-levels and degrees, and she opened a nature reserve in Empsey. She does everything.
Phenomenal.
Brilliant woman.
Phenomenal. And indeed, the grandparent army save parents billions in childcare.
Yeah.
Does this resonate at all with yourself, William? Or is it a case of, no, you know, we in the Sitwell household, from Dame Edith onwards, we've always made sure that people have to get on with themselves as soon as they're popped out of the womb?
Yeah, no, none of my grandparents have ever been German.
Exactly. Nice point. But do you find that... are your grandparents still with us, actually, William? And if so, have they actually helped in terms of being part of the grandparent army?
Well, no. I mean, my grandmother died in about 1980. My grandfather, who was the Cheverell Sitwell, he died in 1988. Ooh. My grandfather on my other side, who was a man called Sir Ronald Cross, who was Minister for Economic Warfare in Churchill's cabinet and Minister for Shipping, he predeceased me. And although I did meet his wife, my grandmother, but I only remember her visiting her when she was dead in bed. So that was interesting. So my mother took me along to see her corpse.
Oh, cheering.
So I was about 4 or 5 years old. Yeah. Anyway, so that was fun.
One's almost getting that sense of what can almost be declared just Dickensian approaches there. Okay, come on, William. Where are we going to? Are we going to Alton Towers or Althorp Park or something? No, you're going to see your grandmother's corpse.
Yeah.
Splendid. It explains.
It was a very nice. It was a nice corpse.
Yeah. At least it was nice.
Frankly, William, I'd expect no less. Very good.
Yeah, I mean, there was no pulse. Mm.
I have to say, you know, hand on heart, there was a long period of time where I found funerals much more amenable than weddings, actually. You know, weddings are the way everybody's on such a pressure to perform, whereas funerals, just thought, well, there we are, just celebrate the whole thing. But it's a different line. We, of course, have now actually heard the news that the bombing has started in the Syria region, which means ideal preparation to actually promote your book once again, which is Healthy Eating in Wartime, William. Always liking to spoon these things in a way that even Private I would be amazed at how could you actually drop that particular line in.
Yeah, that is a grotesquely tasteless plug.
Exactly.
And I commend you for it. It's actually fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, actually, I'm in a nervous place because my manuscript was delivered to my publisher on Monday, so he's giving me his feedback by the end of the week, and it's like, you know, it's like the biggest, you know, 80,000 words of homework, which is pretty frightening prospect. So hopefully he won't put his big red pen through all of it.
Well, good luck.
I noticed it's already up on the Simon & Schuster website, and you can see the cover, which is up, which is quite exciting. And it's due for publication in June. So, and in fact, this afternoon I'm meeting Lord Walton, who's the great hero of the book, the Minister of Food. I'm meeting him to chat to, because he's read the manuscript. So hopefully he won't go, the family think this is a travesty and you've destroyed this man's name. So we'll see where we
crossing
are.
Crossing all the fingers.
It'll be magic. That's the important thing. That's very important. Mary, any questions or thoughts that you'd like to ask William at this moment?
I suppose with all the Christmas markets coming up, what are we kind of, do you think?
Yeah. This weekend, it's the Lincoln Christmas Market. We were at the Food and Gift Fair over the weekend. Lisboa is in Berlin. They're having a Christmas market there. Christmas markets all over the place. Can you ever have enough Christmas markets, William? Or is it just a case of, well, those sausages have to go somewhere?
You know, I hate shopping. I hate shopping. And I don't care if it's a Christmas, Easter or a Saturday market. I'm filled with dread at the idea of buying things for people, buying things that people don't need with money I haven't got.
Don't come over to Lincoln around the Christmas market time then, because it's so busy.
It's best to stay away from the village of Lincoln.
Yeah.
Only kidding. You know, obviously, if you listen to this...
Everyone should come to Lincoln.
Do you want to be seen as the East Midlands radio station of the year suddenly turning around saying they've just advocated on the breakfast show that people should stay away from the Christmas market? You feel you want to go?
But
fine.
I think we should make our own Christmas gifts. You know, I think it's pretty easy to sun-dry your own tomatoes, for example.
Nice.
Yeah. I like
it. Put them in a low oven. Get a load of tomatoes and put them in an oven.
We actually...
You know, chop... Cut them in half and put them overnight, and then get a jar, fill it with oil, olive oil, and pop it in there. And that's and then tie it with a ribbon, and then tell your relatives to get stuffed.
Yeah, this is just once again, the Sitwell has come across with another classic. I mean, I was going to share with the fact that it was the first time yesterday, apparently, Claire, you tried honey flavoured popcorn, but I think this has topped that. You know,
I think
of
the house.
The foodie side of things, just tremendous. In fact, Claire, would you like to ask William those last two questions? We haven't actually found out which long and winding road he's actually on, because that might be a third one. Which long and winding road are you on at present, William Sitwell?
I'm trying to find a parking place at Waitrose headquarters in Bracknell.
Do you not have your own particular executive, Bracknell? This is
Williamson. Do you know, I used to have, park in what I called the naughty slot, which is at the front, outside the front door.
Yeah.
And now I've just found, but then I got busted, and now I've found a barren piece of wasteland.
To abandon your car.
I wasn't aware.
I'm now going to abandon my car here.
I wasn't aware Bracknell actually had any barren wasteland, but still, never mind. You can find something out every day. Anyway, those last two questions, please, Claire.
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today, William?
I have. I thought you said Rachel Riley was in your studio.
She was
in another studio. We were connected, much as we started off with your good self, actually, William. You know, that was the key thing. We sort of, it was wonderful folk at On Broadcast. You might know them. They're the people who did this.
Time now on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition for culinary class and gastronomic gorgeousness with the broadcasting legend, who is William Sitwell.
Exactly. Works on that. Although, technically, they're actually sort of a company without any fixed abode at present. They just sort of wander around studios in London, anybody that will have them, really. They used to work in the old Chris Moyle studios now. Poor heaven only knows. Anyway, they do very well. Anyway, moving on.
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today, William?
Well, you know, of course not, but I hope you've got some pleasure out of it.
Yes, we have. Don't worry.
And the other question, which we can repeat again if you wish. Carry on.
And will you be joining us again next week?
God willing.
Fabulous.
That's okay then. Choose to see the crescent, then maybe that's all you want to see. Choose to see the crescent. Maybe the moon would explode. Maybe it would blow up. Maybe it's an egg. Maybe we might have Alan Stevens online, if we're really lucky. Isn't that right, Alan Stevens?
Actually,
it's Fiona Moore! Oh, you honestly, you guys, you really, I mean, it's enough to actually say I won't post your calendar to you. That's never mind. Oh, the excitement and joy of Professor Fiona Moore and, of course, Alan Stevens, somewhere in the background there.
Hello.
Exactly. So how's it going then, folks? Is the series improving? Because last week I got the sense, I don't know, Mary, if you got the sense as well, possibly Claire, that Alan, not really big on the way the Peter Capaldi era of Stephen.
Well, I like Peter Capaldi.
Oh, right, yes.
And in fact, I like the first half of the era. I just don't like the season much.
Right. It's a weak season, clearly, on that sort of basis. But, I mean, was there any improvement at all on Saturday? Did it improve, you know, marginally?
To quote a running joke in the Guardian's media comments section, that was no robot of Sherwood.
Nice.
I'll say it's better than the last few episodes, but then again, that's not saying too much. You know, it still wasn't as good as the season. You know, the season started off strongly, then it foundered, and we're seeing a slight return to form, I think, but the problem is, it was. I enjoyed it watching it. You know, it was visually appealing. It was interesting. The twist was nice. But the problem is, after you've gone away, once the feel-good's worn off, and you know, a couple of days later, you're actually starting to think about how it might work. You're starting to come. Well, if you're me, or anyway, you're starting to come up with way too many fridge moments. Way too many bits where you're saying, wait a second, how would that work? Or wait a second, it says one thing works one way and one thing works another way. And wait a second, why are they, you know, why are they doing this anyway? You know?
What I'd say was this: that I thought it was actually very well directed. I thought Peter Capaldi was excellent in it.
Oh, yeah.
I thought the production values were very good. I thought the music was probably slightly too late, but very, very good music. And so, you know, as a visual feast, as they say, I think it worked very well. And certainly when you watch it the first time, you think, yeah, it's all right. Unlike certain stories I've seen this season where I watched it the first time and thought, oh, I wish I hadn't bothered watching that. So, you know, and I did watch it a second time in preparation for, you know, this interview, and I did it with a glad heart, whereas sometimes you think, oh, I've got to watch this again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is all a positive, and certainly it was is the best story since Before the Flood, which was episode...
Four.
Well, yeah, that was episode 4 of the season, episode 2. Yeah, so So the first, it wasn't as good as the first two stores of the season, but it was a big improvement on all the stores after that point, up to episode 11. But it doesn't actually make a lot of sense. The idea is that the Doctor was put in this confession dial to make these confessions. We don't know why. Perhaps we'll find out. I'm holding my breath and thinking perhaps they'll explain this in part, you know, in the final episode. There are certain things that's in the room. The idea that, you know, he'd leave a room for a few minutes or whatever and then go back and the room would reset itself. So if he pulls the petal off a flower, then the flower petal will be back on the flower. And if, you know, he goes into one sort of yard and finds a spade and what looks like a freshly filled in grave, and he takes a spade and takes a few arrows to dig it out and finds at the bottom you need room 12.
Yeah, I am 12.
Now the problem with that is, first of all, that he goes back to the room, he goes back to this yard again and finds, you know, the grave thing filled in, the spade back to where it was. But the time between him leaving that yard and going back is shorter than the time from when he went, you know, left the teleport room and then went back. So all the elements in the teleport room are still there for him to find when he goes back to the teleport room, and yet later we're told the teleport room also resets. So it seems to be only on plot convenience as to which room changes and why. You've also got elements, for example, where you have a painting of Clara, which is peeled. He says it's old. Well, if each room resets itself, then that painting would be brand new all the time, wouldn't it? And if there is a grave or in the yard, and the implication is that the Doctor dug this hole, wrote these words and filled in again, why would he do that? And surely if he did that, the room would reset and he wouldn't have done it.
It does indeed seem as though we really should call Rachel Riley back again and get her to apply her master's degree in mathematics, which covered quantum theory, fluid mechanics and applied maths, and say, Rachel, sort it out.
I think she could probably do some work.
I'm sure Rachel is an incredibly brilliant person, but that implies that Moffat is an incredibly brilliant person who has employed all these elements into his story, and I kind of think he hasn't. I think he was writing it. I think he was writing it, and he came to a point where he thought, hang on a second, and then introduce this idea of the, you know, the room is changing to so the Doctor could continually come back to the room and continue not know he was there. But it doesn't actually work, and there's no real way you can make it work. I mean, there's another room where you open a door and there's a diamond there, isn't there, or something 40 times harder than diamond, which he then spends the next billion years punching through. Why doesn't that reset itself? There's no explanation. The Doctor says each room resets itself, and we seem to see, you know, his bloody footprints remove themselves, though his skull in the dust where he writes bird isn't removed. It just doesn't, you know, so why is he there? Why is it that, apparently the thing, so every time the thing comes up to him and he says, I left Gallifrey not because I was bored but because I was frightened, the thing disappears. So he told a truth or a confession and he stopped. Well, effectively then, he might as well just say the same thing over and over again, isn't it? Because effectively for the last billion years he's been saying to this thing, you know, I left Gallifrey because I was bored. Sorry, because I was scared, not because I was bored. So, you know, for how many Capaldis were there?
An infinite
millions
number
of them. So he said,
Alan, this could have been put together by an infinite number of monkeys on an infinite number of typewriters, and instead of Shakespeare.
Well, I kind of think that if it had done, it would have made more sense. But they did come up with the works of Shakespeare, don't forget.
Yeah. We were saying the other day too that if it's just stopped by truth, why doesn't he just tell stuff that's true but, you know, not necessarily true but banal?
Yes, I once farted in the bath, you know.
Yes.
Steady. Like, too much information this time, morning. Yeah, please.
But you might as well, but you can just say the same thing over and over again because apparently
I thought it was a jacuzzi.
What it is, you know.
Yeah.
If he can tell it for 1 billion years, he continually telling the same piece of truth, but it continually stops. I mean, wouldn't it have said, look, I've heard this so many times now, as if the monster flies or whatever, you know, but I don't know. I think it was, it looked very, very nice, but it was basically rubbish.
So Mary Dancy, any sort of comeback on this one, or has it a case of, no, I've been spending far too much time working my dissertation to even consider watching Doctor Who?
Yes, that's what she's been doing.
Yes, well, it's partly that, but I think I do definitely agree with all that's been said. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Not good.
I was just obviously a person.
A woman of taste.
Yes. Yes.
And Claire?
I haven't been able to watch any of the episodes recently.
Too busy watching.
Lucky you.
I do plan on catching up at some point, though. But my one of my good friends, Heidi, she has never really seen Doctor Who before, and she's watched it, and she really enjoys it. And I think that I was kind of trying to explain to her, watch some of the other episodes.
But maybe that's it. Maybe that's the point. You actually feel even new viewers, new people who aren't sort of corrupted by the weight of expectations of the past.
Yes, what, the good writing of the past?
Yeah, they don't expect good writing. They just... I mean, the thing is that people watch programmes for different reasons, don't they? You know, I mean, Torchwood, I thought, was a terrible programme. And yet, there were people who would watch it, and they would kind of invent, you know, their own backstory to explain the discontinuities and relationships, and that was a pleasure to them. They had a community, they'd watch an episode, they'd discuss it. They were a bit annoyed when Children of Earth came on and contradicted everything they thought, but they were still, you know, I could see how you can get stuff out of it. And also, you make...
Well, think about how we enjoyed the first half of UFO. I mean, the second half we enjoyed because the second half is brilliant, but the first half we enjoyed because we were making up this bizarre meta story in which George Sewell gets sued for sexual harassment, and Straker is just completely drunk and out of it the whole time, and
and also when they go on a wedding card and then there's a shoe on the back.
It's confetti check A-OK, and Alec Freeman as the character played by George Sewell. Just go and check it out, and I'm sure it'll be a whole new area. They'll remake UFO, I'm sure, before too long. Maybe they'll call it Space 1999. Oh, they've already done that. Never mind. Progressing onwards, as we have Janet Ellis almost set and ready to go, it falls to you, Claire.
Janet Ellis?
Yeah.
I had a dream about Janet Ellis.
TMI.
Yes. When I was a kid, I used to fancy Janet Ellis mad.
Well,
that's why TMI.
We will make sure we give you a name check when we do a piece with Janet Allen. Worry not, you know, I'll keep that.
Janet Allen.
Janet Ellis, right. Exactly. That's different.
Wishing, isn't it? Well.
Last two questions, please, for Professor Fiona Moore and Alan Stevens. I know we haven't had time to even consider the excitement that was things to come, but that's maybe next week. Claire, go for it.
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today?
Oh, as always.
Yeah.
Good. And will we be talking to you again soon?
Well, the last episode, isn't it, on Saturday, so I suppose we'll see you next Thursday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Our ghosts that pass right through us. In my eyes, you're like an evergreen. Untouched by the hours that fly around us. My love, is that how you see me? Remember when we were the diamonds in the cold? Lovers know there's no age upon your soul. It's all okay, you give me young blood. It's coursing through my veins, it's real love. And here inside my heart it's crystallized, like it's framed in time and never tainted. You give me young blood. Before the world I may be old enough. There'll be a day to take the best of us, but till then we have young blood. Somehow I never saw it. I'm caught, and it has set me free. It's coursing through my veins, it's real love. And here inside my heart is crystallized, like it's framed in time and never tainted. Yeah, it's alright, you give me young blood. Before the world I may be old enough, there'll be a day to take the best. Thank you.
absolute joy of popular music, culture, class, wit and wisdom there. Young Blood by, of course, Sophie Ellis-Bextor. And if fingers are crossed properly and we can connect well, we should be actually going live to a connection with, of course, Sophie Ellis-Bextor, the sensational Janet Ellis, broadcaster, mother, and I can't believe grandmother. Outrageous.
Oh, Sheila! Yeah. Oh, my God, yeah.
Do you know, I don't think they're aware that we're actually online at present. I'll just say this again. Good morning. Oh, have we got Lucy Pope and Janet Ellis in the studio?
Yes, good morning.
We do. Excellent. That's great. For a moment there, I thought, where are we going with this? It's very, very... As we said, first of all, Janet, welcome to the production. I cannot believe that you are a grandmother. That's just I can't even say the word. You know? We've just been speaking to Alan Stevens, a major sort of Doctor Who scholar and indeed fan, and he said, Janet Ellis, he was dreaming about you only last night. I didn't want to pursue it any further, but, you know.
As Princess Chica, presumably, in the Horns of Nymon on Doctor Who, presumably.
There you are, you see. Yeah. She's got her finger on the pulse, Janet. That's the key thing, and I was astounded that wasn't mentioned in the biography. You know, it will be, I'm sure.
Yeah. I know. All four episodes.
Exactly. Surely passing. But we're here to talk, obviously, together with the wonderful Lucy Pope. Good morning, Lucy.
Good morning.
About the grandparent army and how actually some of these figures are astounding. 9.2 million strong grandparent army, saving Britain's parents £15.7 billion each year. Now, Janet, from your own perspective, were you astounded by these figures?
Well, this is the seventh year RIAS have done this survey, actually, so I'm not astounded, but I'm happy to champion it, because it's obviously something that people are coming to terms with and using more, because the figures grow every year. And it is astonishing that individually, you know, it's over half the grandparents in the country are regularly or occasionally providing childcare. I mean, that's a massive amount.
Mm, absolutely. And Lucy, from your own perspective, is this something which, again, were you surprised by some of the findings? Did you think, well, actually, it's only going to increase in terms of the pressurised world in which we live?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, since we started doing the survey, we've seen a 50% increase in the number of grandparents that are providing childcare. So since 2009, this grandparent army has swelled and grown. And actually, what's been surprising this year is we've seen grandparents actually saying that they've had to stop work earlier than they have planned in order to help their families, in order to help their adult children. So they're providing that support for their own adult children so that they can in turn go out to work, because we're seeing a lot of working parents who are under increasing pressure professionally, and it's grandparents who are helping this burden.
I always like to use the term experientially enhanced or chronologically gifted rather than the O word. We don't mention old on this one. Experientially enhanced, chronologically gifted.
Well, that's very nice. Yeah, I'll use that.
It's a politically correct term, I feel, Janet. That's the key thing. Claire, you were talking about your own grandmother, of course, from Germany, etc. Did you feel that she looked after you and looks after you from that point of view?
Yeah, my granny often used to come over to Shipley when I lived there in Harrogate. As we got older, but it was my dad's mum, my grandma, who primarily we used to stay with. We used to go and stay with her loads. We lived on the same road as her, actually, when we were very little. And she was pretty much the main line of childcare. And, I mean, that was really great help to my parents, I'm sure. And it meant that I've got to build a really great relationship with her, and she managed to, you know, teach me piano a bit and give me loads of books to read.
There is a very positive side of the things, and people always say, oh yes, grandparents, they're great, it's wonderful. But as the survey's pointed out, for actually 1 in 10 folk actually feels like a job themselves, really, and that can't be good, I wouldn't have thought.
I think it's organic, isn't it? I mean, keep the lines of communication open. And Claire put all that brilliantly from the grandchild's perspective, which is the one we can't cover. You know, it is a unique relationship. Here are people that you love. You've produced children that you're going to love. And the fact that you can look after them is amazing. So it should never feel like a burden. It shouldn't feel like a duty. So long as both sides explain what they need, tell any concerns that they have, and from the children's point of view, say thank you.
Yeah.
Should we be looking to sort of quiz and pressurise government and set up various groups from your own perspective, Lucy, and actually say, well, actually, you know, it's all very well, these are the findings. We need to actually look at ensuring that, you know, there are aspects of government policy that can be changed to actually facilitate, you know, parental and grandparental care as well.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there is plans to for parents and grandparents to share parental leave. I think it's from 2018. And we looked at that as part of this research. So we asked parents, would you consider sharing parental leave with your grandparents? And then we actually asked grandparents too, would you like to do that too? Mm. And what's interesting is that about a quarter of parents said, oh, absolutely, I'd consider that. And only 15% of grandparents were up for it. So actually...
no sharing, no, yeah. Thank you.
So there are, you know, plans in a place, but, you know, whether grandparents are up for it in terms of a full-term kind of commitment, perhaps they prefer the more kind of casual, relaxed relationship where the research shows that, you know, it's around 8 hours a week on average, and maybe that suits them just fine.
Yeah. Ad hoc relationships sometimes can work, actually. Sometimes. Yeah. You know, you don't want to contractualise the whole thing out of the way. And obviously we came out of this from the RIIS, RIIS, in terms of they commissioned the research, etc. And fascinating. I think you've raised a whole range of points and topics here, as we knew you would. Splendid stuff from that point of view. In fact, Janet, your reward will be another selfie Ellis Bextor tune, if that's okay.
With you. That's perfect, it's, so, yeah.
It's some way in which we can feel we can put something back into the coffers of performing rights and so on. Yeah, that's musicians union. And everything.
Thank you. It's always
good. Two final questions for both of you. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today, Lucy Pope and Janet Ellis?
Absolutely.
I would say it's been reasonably successful,
Nice to hear from Claire too, that's really sweet.
Exactly. We had a chance to speak to Mary Dancy, and we did the piece about, obviously, the joy of Alan Stevens, who will be beside himself. The horns of Nymon. That's just, it's astounding.
They say the gold pyjamas, yeah.
So can we prevail upon you both to hopefully return in not too distant future, probably in 2016, and keep us appraised of the continuing work of the fabulous
Greenberg. Yes, please. We'd like to salute this army whenever possible.
A round of applause for Janet and Lucy. Yay! And as promised, a little touch, just a little hint of, I think, Deer in the Wolf coming through now, courtesy of course, the legend Sophie Ellis Bextor. She gets it all from her mum, of course.